I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The biologist and writer, E for Edward, O for Osborne, Wilson, is the giant in our midst this radio hour. He's the man who learned to talk to the ants in their own language of smells or pheromones. We're speaking with him and about him with the decorated science historian Richard Rhodes, best known for his definitive account of the making of the atomic bomb. Richard Rhodes has written a new biography and appreciation of E.O. Wilson and his life in nature. The book is called Scientist, and it starts with a bang, like this, from 1954. Finally, Ed Wilson was on his way, 25 years old, tall and lanky, the upper range of his hearing gone since his teens, his right eye ruined in a childhood fishing accident, so he's half deaf and half blind. Outwardly, he was a polite, soft-spoken product of Gulf Coast, Alabama, the first of his family to graduate from college. But behind the good-mannered finish, he was as tough as nails, as bright as the evening star, and no man's fool. He would become one of the half-dozen greatest biologists of the 20th century. What a story, Richard Rhodes, and thank you for telling it.
And I kind of underestimated perhaps his stature there by calling him one of the half dozen. He's popularly known, and I think even in scientific community known, as Darwin's successor.
Yeah, not an easy post, especially after the discovery of DNA, which changed the science entirely. Richard Rhodes, I'd love you to just cut to the chase to one of his great triumphs. And I could almost see him in your account of it. It was Ed Wilson learning how to talk to his insects. What he knew was that they communicated by smells, pheromones. But then he figured out how he could do it too.
Yes. It had been popularly assumed before that when ants tweedled their antenna together with each other, they were somehow sending signals that way. But animals that live underground generally don't use eyes and ears. They use smells primarily. And in this case, the question really was, where was this odor being presented? And Ed started investigating his favorite research animal, which is the fire ant, which has many virtues, including easy to maintain and all those things. But it's very small. It's about the size of a large crumb of bread. So working within that scale without having any elaborate technological system in hand in his laboratory to magnify this ant, but merely a very large magnifying glass. It looks from the photographs as if it weighed maybe 5 pounds at least. He started prizing out little parts of the ant's abdomen. He finally lit upon this tiny little gland that didn't look like it was much of anything. And when he put a little bit of the secretion from this gland onto a little piece of balsam and laid it in the courtyard of his ant colony on his desk at the Harvard Museum of Biology, the ants came roaring out of their colony and raced along the line he'd drawn.
Yeah, and they reacted as if they'd heard a fire alarm or something.
Well, as soon as they smelled it, then boom, off they went.
Richard, when I spoke with Ed Wilson last week, I told him that I thought of him with his magnifying glass focused so hard on those little creatures, and I asked him what it was like to be in that relationship.
Thrilling, because I knew ants had to be chemical communicators. They had to be smelling and tasting the signals that they used. So I set out to find out if that was true. And I used fire ants. So I had a lot of those to work with in the laboratory.
They bite, right?
I think I may hold the world record of being stung by the most fire ants. I took these ants, they're just like a grain of salt, and I could tease apart the abdomen of a fire ant and then remove different glands from the rear abdomen. And this was an exciting moment. I came to a little gland, finally teased it loose, took the contents of it, almost an invisible amount, making an artificial trail away from the nest. And the ant nest exploded. Wow. They came pouring out. That was it.
This puts Dr. Doolittle to shame in a way. I mean, this is really communicating with the animals.
It really is.
Ed Wilson got typecast by history, but maybe by temperament too, in what became known as the molecular wars of the 1950s. It began, of course, with Crick and Watson identifying and describing DNA, you know, submicroscopic DNA as the code of life. He said to me in some frustration not so long ago that big time science from then on had very little interest in anything larger than a cell. He was forever a species guy and remained that way. But it became a personal rivalry between James Watson and Ed Wilson, both Americans, both still alive, the classic field biologist and the classic lab guy, and they didn't like each other. Can you explain all that or just describe this rivalry?
Well, Watson said later that he felt in order to move what he called all these stamp collectors, meaning field biologists, basically.
Yeah, the bird watchers, he called them.
Yes, and stamp collectors both, right? They went out in the field and they collected living organisms and they studied them. And from his point of view, you didn't need to do that anymore. Now that we understood that life was organized on a molecular basis in the form of this long string of individual molecules that together are the template for life, he thought you could do everything in the laboratory. But he also knew he had to clear the decks, as it were. So when he was hired at Harvard after this great discovery...
This is Watson now.
And came to Harvard the same year Wilson did. Wilson was there as part of this collection of people that he wanted to get rid of. Well, Ed is a very gracious, warm Southern gentleman in presentation, but he has a will of steel, maybe titanium. And he wasn't about to be moved aside. He didn't agree with this theory. You couldn't do it all in the lab. Organisms at each scale have their own specific biology. You can't do molecules and understand the behavior of a colony of ants. It's too complicated.
I'll tell you a story. It was the early 1960s. The molecular biologists, as they call themselves, scored a huge success. And now they were aggressive about it. They wanted to see Harvard switch over as quickly as possible.
To settle the territory, so to speak.
That's a good analogy. I was probably the youngest of the full professors teaching traditional biology, which is mainly the variety of life. So the senior faculty at Harvard met to discuss how we can make it clear how important our biology is to strengthen our image and somehow make the best of molecular biology, which was a great leap forward.
So Ed wanted to save field biology, basically. But at the same time, he understood it had gotten kind of lazy. Everybody had his own favorite organism, and that's what they studied. And there wasn't much cross-cultural fertilization going on.
Yeah, at times it's hilariously funny. I mean,
it is.
Wilson, as it happened, got tenure at Harvard first. Watson was volcanically unhappy about that. Ed Wilson referred to Watson as the most unpleasant man he'd ever met. And he remembers, even now, nicknaming Watson Caligula.
The Caligula of biology.
It started out you calling him the most unpleasant man you'd ever met, and the faculty called him Caligula.
I called him Caligula, too. Anyway, for a while there, about all I had in defense was insult.
How did that ice break? How did the relationship evolve, as we should say?
Mutual respect. Increasing mutual respect. There was a little tangle of emotions. But for my part, it was admiration and a desire to make the most of this glorious new chapter of biology, molecular and cell biology, and so on.
That's what's interesting. I mean, Ed really is able to be a serious scientist, of course, but part of that means being objective about what the facts are. And from his point of view, the work that Watson and Crick had done was the most profound thing in biology since the beginning. No one had done anything deeper in the whole field, well, up to Darwin. That Crick and Watson and Darwin were kind of it. So he respected him as a scientist, but he did not respect him as a man because Watson was so very cruel to people. He wouldn't speak to people he didn't respect. He and Ed passed each other in the hallways of the biology laboratories for years and never spoke to each other.
Yeah, they've gotten over that, apparently. And you'd have to say the molecular scientists won the battle, in a sense. I mean, they dominate the field now, science of genomes and all that. And yet you wonder, there's a joy in that species biology. There's also a kind of expansive humanity in just contemplating a bird or a rhinoceros or an ant that doesn't come out of a lab.
No. And if you jump forward for a moment, Ed's work and the work of scientists like Ed really has come into the forefront again with the incredible destruction and extinction of species that's going on today. But I just want to say, Ed's work is equally important. The molecular part is really good, rich, deep science, to be sure. And it's had enormous consequences, particularly in human medicine and places like that, and much more to come. But at the same time, it's we as a species among the millions of species alive still in the world, but disappearing at a ferocious rate of one right. extinction per day, that Ed is deeply concerned about now and that I think makes his work very important again.
My question, and I think listeners would be wondering, we hear of a crash of species. It could be that a million different flora and fauna are endangered right now out of maybe 10 million species overall. The orangutan, the Asian elephant, the bluefin tuna, green turtles, chimpanzees, for crying out loud. Why is that important? Other than we're going to miss the chimpanzees.
We don't know what the real links are in the ecosystems that they are part of. We don't know what would happen if you allowed the chain of extinction to proceed until it begins to affect a whole ensemble of species interdependent upon each other. We still haven't given enough thought and experiment to make predictions about the ultimate effects of a single extinction by one species or a particular combination of species. We're just beginning to ask the right questions.
Coming up, the biology of human behavior and culture. This is Open Source. It's a funny thing to discover about an ant biologist, but there is rapture in E.O. Wilson's work and in his face today when he talks about it. I told him I associate it with Vladimir Nabokov, of all people, the Lolita novelist, who actually had an office next to Ed Wilson's in the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard in the 1940s. He was a butterfly guy, the way you were an ant guy. What was he like?
The author. We got into interesting discussions, but they were mostly discussions of adventure. And that's what really keeps naturalists going. They live for adventure.
And of course, Nabokov had just written Lolita, and he was also an avid butterfly guy, wrote endlessly about it. And in his memoir, Speak Memory, there's this passage that I can imagine Ed Wilson saying about ants. Here's what Nabokov said about butterflies. He said, "When I stand among rare butterflies and their food plants, this is ecstasy, and behind the ecstasy is something else, which is hard to explain. It's like a momentary vacuum into which rushes all that I love, the sense of oneness with sun and stone, a thrill of gratitude to whom it may concern, to the contrapuntal genius of human fate, or to tender ghosts humoring a lucky mortal." I put it to Richard Rhodes that nobody writes like Nabokov, but I think Ed Wilson felt a lot of that.
Oh, yes. There's a wonderful moment in one of his excursions into the rainforest where he goes out away from the camp, which is noisy and had lots of light pollution, walks back into the rainforest, not very far. And he's suddenly in such pitch darkness that he can't see his hand in front of his face. He has a light on his hat, and he switches it on, and down on the forest floor are all these wonderful wolf spiders running around. And when he turns on the light, they all stop and they look up at him And he looks down at them, and he has this sense that he's studying them, to be sure, but they're studying him as well. And they're all kind of frozen for this wonderful moment of recognition among species that are very, very far apart in evolutionary terms. So he has that sense too, and it's really, it comes through in the lyricism of his writing in Popular Science. Anyone who hasn't read his autobiography, Naturalist, should pick it up because it's an absolutely delightful book.
Ed Wilson kept his own personal ant colony in a glass and plastic box at his Harvard office on Oxford Street there in Cambridge, so he could watch the hierarchy of ant world, the busyness of it, the specialties among hundreds of workers. And the question was sort of inevitable, what was the counterpart in other species and the human species of the hierarchy, the specialties, the social standing, so clearly differentiated in ant world? Ed Wilson's answer was a new scientific field called sociobiology, and it proved to be fiercely controversial. Walk us through the sociobiology fight, Richard Rhodes, in the late 70s, early 80s.
Let me just insert here something that I think is fascinating about Ed. How has he managed to come from being a collector of ants to a world-class scientist who's sometimes called Darwin's successor? He grows each new phase of his life. He expands his reach. He takes on more than he thinks he can handle. Ed got to the point where he knew something well enough that he would write a synthesis of the whole field. He did that with ants in a book that won a Pulitzer Prize. And once he'd done that, I think he wanted to look farther. And at that point, he started looking at the question of how much of human behavior, not the color of our eyes and the color of our hair and those things, but our behavior, how much of human behavior is evolved, is fixed by our evolutionary genes rather than something that we learn after we're born. Now, for a long time in anthropology and in sociology, it had been accepted that we were born as tabula rasa.
Yeah, the blank slate argument.
A blank slate, exactly. And therefore, unlike all the other species in the world, we had no biological kind of components to our behavior. He's developed a model based on all this evidence that he's reviewed for human behavior as partly determined and partly free. Something quite different from what some of his colleagues at Harvard preferred to think human beings had. And as soon as sociobiology, the book that resulted, was published, there was kind of a firestorm started. First of all, with a really brutal letter attacking him that appeared in the New York Review of Books, which was then a new and really vital periodical in the world of intellectual discourse.
Was this Richard Lewontin or is it a whole group?
There was Richard Lewontin and a number of others as well.
Yeah, including Stephen Jay Gould, famous writer.
Yeah.
Also a celebrity on the Harvard faculty.
Exactly. So when Ed came up with a counterargument, they saw him as some kind of right-wing guy who was trying to support the status quo with all of its evils and so forth. And they wrote in a letter to the New York Review that this theory of his actually moved him over into the world of eugenics, the old pseudoscience of improving the species by selective breeding, which they said in turn pointed in the direction of the Nazi death camps. Now, that is about as brutal as you can get.
And it got worse, in a sense. There was an anthropological conference in New York, I'm pretty sure, late 70s, and protesters came up and poured a pitcher of cold water on Ed Wilson's head. And people got kind of scared. Where was this going? They shouted, "Wilson, you're all wet." And Ed Wilson later claimed a piece of the glory. He said, "I believe I was the only scientist in modern times to be physically attacked for an idea."
Yeah. And, you know, that pitcher of cold water really did bother him a lot. But before that, he had been bothered by this attack in the New York Review of Books, and it unsettled him. He had really taken a big leap into an area that he knew was fraught with all sorts. You think about the religious objections to thinking of humans as being somehow determined. That's not what the Bible says. It says we have a choice for good or for evil. So from many points of view, he was a little bit less than confident in his presentation, and it really shook him when that letter appeared. And he told me, he said, for several days I went through this period of agonizing when I asked myself, am I going to be a failure as a scientist? Am I going to be laughed off the faculty? Have I made a fatal mistake in making this presentation? But he said, I went back mentally and reviewed my evidence. And once I'd done that, I realized that I had a perfectly solid case to make. And I wasn't upset after that, except that I was worried for my family, his wife and his daughter. He was concerned that they might in some way be attacked, as of course people are experiencing today. That bothered him, but he then wrote a very angry letter back to the New York Review defending his point of view. And then all these other things followed. There was a protest in Harvard Square. Some people were asking for him to be fired from the Harvard faculty. The Anthropological Association of America was about to vote a no confidence in him as a scientist. And at the height of the preparation to vote, who walks in the room but Margaret Mead, the great, famous, internationally famous, small, compact, very, very charismatic woman, quite elderly by then, actually. She, at that point in her life, was using a 6-foot stick as a cane. And when she walked in the room, she said, am I to understand that we're just about to vote on a matter of scientific fact? And she banged the cane on the floor and everybody sat up straight. And she said, that smacks to me of book burning. So that one didn't happen. But the pitcher of water a couple of years later did indeed happen. And it shook Ed too. Not because of the water, but because no one in the room came to his support. They just sat there and watched all this go on stage where he was the speaker without standing up and protesting. Then there was a kind of belated round of applause for him. But he was really, I think, bothered by that as much as any aspect of it all, that his colleagues were so timid.
You know, it's fascinating, just about the man, for a courtly gent with a bit of a southern touch about him, he had an unlikely taste for battle, and he was good at it, too, and he didn't hold back. I mean, he called Stephen Jay Gould a charlatan. He called Richard Dawkins a non-scientist, never done experimental work, and he certainly gave as good as he got. But who would you say won that battle? And it's still out there, the nature-nurture question.
The nature-nurture question may be, but I think the question of sociobiology is not. Ed finally concluded that maybe 10% of human behavioral traits are inherited. And even those he sees more like patterns of how you learn than anything specific. So from his point of view, it was 90% free, 10% determined. A group of scientists a couple of years ago looked over 50 years of identical twin studies, and they looked particularly at those studies that had to do with twins who'd been separated at birth and raised in different places by different families. And that study concluded, after looking at some, the number is hard to believe, 100-something thousand pairs of identical twins, that inheritance is about 49% of our behavior.
Of what kind of traits, for example? What do we do that we don't realize is from the family tree?
I think probably we're talking about things like ability to be good at math, kind of physical forms in the people we desire.
Musical gifts, perhaps?
Musical gifts, comfort around strangers. There are lots of things like that that I think add up to the generalized, rather seemingly vague, not very specific background that we all bring to our lives when we're born. Two twins raised apart are brought together for the first time, and they discover that they both like to wear rubber bands on their arms and snap the rubber band. That's one real example that I recall. I mean, it's just uncanny, the things between identical twins. It really seems uncanny to the rest of us, I think.
For a famous Ant-Man, Ed Wilson had a real gift at synthesizing other kinds of knowledge and writing about it spectacularly well. I mean, we're going to be talking about things he wrote, I think, for a long, long time. One of his gifts was to ride the horses of humanism on one side and science on the other at the same time. And for the most part, it's rather remarkable, he escaped the slur of scientism, going too far with his laboratory knowledge. I mean, speak of that incredible breadth of the man's work.
What he does is he just steps forward and leans over and looks down on this warehouse full of science work and then tries to find the underlying connections, how this pallet is wheeled over next to that pallet. And I mean, I'm visualizing the Amazon warehouse right now, but it's that sort of thing that he does. So, and almost no one in science does that kind of thing. He crossed that barrier that the English physicist and novelist C.P. Snow spoke of many years ago as this barrier between science and humanism. He's found ways to connect. He's won two Pulitzers, which, as he often points out with some amusement, are actually given for literary style, not for your science.
Keep going, Richard Rose, on this business of Ed Wilson, the writer, the aphorist, who speaks in such incisive phrases. My picture of Ed Wilson is still a scene 20 years ago or so at MIT against a huge wall projection of the astronaut's picture of the Earth rising, so-called blue marble, and a variety of eminent people were asked to comment on it. Ed Wilson said very simply, look at that picture. At that scale, the biosphere, where all the birds and the whales and we and the trees and everything are contained, that's as thin as a razor's edge. Now, here's the point about it. Take the human species out of that layer of life, and it would be safe forever. Take the ants out of it, and it would be doomed. But he thinks it's one of the great assignments of science today to map all the interactions of millions and millions of species. It sounds like an infinite project. He's so excited, though, and wishing he were a graduate student today with that project ahead of him.
We need to find out what all the species on Earth are and what their status is. We need to have what I like to call a Linnaean Renaissance, a complete taxonomy of all the species of plants, animals, and microorganisms on Earth, included fungi. If we get serious about identifying and characterizing in traits and in distribution around the world every species of organism, Linnaean Renaissance, you know, to complete what Linnaeus began, and then seriously study these species and the combinations they make as a major part of science, then we will find out how to avoid even local catastrophes due to species extinction. I wish I was just starting out as a graduate student.
He has never lost that sense of wonder. And that's when Ed breaks out and finds another new area where he can be uncertain and nervous and lying awake at night, whatever we do when we're anxious about mastering a new subject or a new technique. And then he moves into that, and when he writes his book about it, then he pulls everything together. So he's been trying ever since the late 1970s, when it really dawned on him that there was an urgent need to start saving species around the world before so many go extinct that the whole system falls apart. And At first, he tried to find a way to raise a whole new generation of scientists, field scientists, who could go out and collect all these different creatures and so forth. And then he started looking again, well, what other could we do? One of the things he did was to contribute to the development of the Encyclopedia of Life, which is simply at least one page on the World Wide Web about each different species in the world. And you can go to Encyclopedia of Life on your computer, anyone who's listening, and just type those words in, and you will go to this magnificent, it's already got tens of thousands of species identified, including man, in the same exact way as all the others. Description of who they are, their scientific names, their basic features, and so forth. And surprisingly enough, there are something like, I can't quite remember the exact percentage, but it's more than half of the species in the world have never been named, never been described, never been identified. And until we do that, we're not even going to know what we're losing. And we are losing species that we don't even know are there. So from his point of view, knowledge is the first step. And from that, we can then go on to the next step, which is to preserve as islands, if you will. He calls this his half-Earth idea. We save half the Earth, more or less, what's still in the form of wilderness, however patchy it might be. We save half the Earth for the natural world, and we live on the other half, which has more than enough resources to support us all, especially when we get to a steady state population, which we're predicted to reach by the year 2100 at about 7.5 billion people.
Coming up, the fate of the planet and of our species on it. Ed Wilson's anxieties are still evolving. This is Open Source. E.O. Wilson surprised me some when I asked about the crisis of the human species on Earth post-Glasgow. I should have known that his view would reflect his evolutionary and experimental habits of mind. How long do we have, Ed, and what can be done to prevent the collapse of this planet? Martin Rees, the royal astronomer, says this Earth has been around for something like 75 million centuries, and there's a chance that we're sitting in the last one.
I don't believe that for a moment. Insofar as humanity is a cause of climate change, what people created, once they understand what's happening, people can stop and reverse.
But when the species are gone, they're gone.
So the question is, what species matter? I mean, what combination of species gone extinct provide a runaway self-intensifying episode of an extinction, which turns into mass extinction? And we haven't seen that. What we've seen is just a blind exploitation of our resources and a careless allowing of a number of key species to go extinct. But so far, I don't think we've set ourselves on an irreversible pathway toward destruction.
Now, he seems to have come to a somewhat more optimistic perspective than he had 20 years ago. He now says, and this is the irony, by the way, of this seeming increase in optimism on Ed's part. He says at the end of what I think is his most powerful and wonderful book on human nature, that when we have squared the circle, when we have leveled off our population, when we have mastered disease, when we have stabilized the natural world, we will come to a time when we realize that, like the other species in the world, we have no purpose here beyond our own reproduction. That all the love and hate and passion and desire and ecstasy finally come down to simply reproducing our kind. That is a tragic view of the world, but it is the one that I believe.
It sounds reductionist to me, a word he hates and he doesn't like to be considered that way, but that's not the whole story.
there's a deeper sense, and this is his non-Christian point of view about the world, that there's no purpose beyond. Ed is basically taking a Darwinian point of view and saying, here we are, we're just another animal among the animals. It's maybe take out the just, and you have a clear scientific perspective on the human world, however much we would like it to be otherwise.
Well, that makes me want to say, but he was more than a scientist, and his imagination went way beyond that short definition. Which brings me back to the aphorist in Ed Wilson on big themes. Robert Krulwich of radio fame asked him not so long ago, will we solve the crises of the next 100 years? And Wilson said, yes, if we are honest and smart. He said, the real problem of humanity is the following. We have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and godlike technology, and it is terrifically dangerous, and it is now approaching a point of crisis overall.
Yes, well, there we are. He seems to have begun to think that perhaps we're easing past that point of crisis. I don't think I'd agree with him, but I've written the history of nuclear weapons, so I have a different perspective. But in any case, I see someone coming to the end of his life and not wanting to be one of those guys who says, get off my lawn. He wants to take a more bountiful perspective on the human world. And why not?
You spoke of your own work, Richard Rhodes, Pulitzer Prize winner yourself for your history of nuclear weapons, J. Robert Oppenheimer and Company and all that. Which makes me wonder, what's your observation of big differences, critical differences between the physical scientists and the biological scientists? I'd love your general tear and compare between the physicists of the sort that built the bomb and the biologists who haven't built their bomb yet.
Well, there's your point. Biology is going to be the deadly science, potentially, in the next 100 years, given its development of technologies for changing our species, for making unbelievable diseases. But my daughter is a molecular biologist.
Ah.
And when I asked her why she went to that science rather than physics, which she was certainly exposed to as a child around me, she said, oh, physics is so dead.
Wow,
and I thought, well, yeah, I suppose it is if you don't kind of personify all those particles. But there is a difference. And yet, I, of course, have known many physicists whose perspective on the world was more like Ed's and who, after all, believed deeply as a result of their experience during the Second World War and the development of the bomb, that the bomb was going to be a kind of an inoculation against war and death. And in a way, it has been that. We have had no world-scale wars since 1945. And that may be just the luck of the draw, because there certainly have been a lot of close calls over the years. Many, many times when the world was very close to nuclear war. And that would have had deep, profound consequences, almost on the scale of the asteroid impact that caused the extinction of the dinosaurs. We still have enough weapons around to do that. So we're still hanging by a thread. But Ed would seem to have moved a little bit beyond that thread and to feel maybe something is being woven that will be a little stronger to support us. You know, there was a psychologist named Albert Ellis who once said, you know, there are only two ways to look at the future. You're either waiting for death or you're waiting for Santa Claus. And I think we need to shift a little bit more toward waiting for Santa Claus. And that's certainly what Ed is doing.
I want to come back to his views on religion. Above all, they're ambiguous. He grew up in a world of Southern Baptist Christians. He outgrew it as a worldview, of course, but he never seemed alienated from his childhood and that sense of the world. He accepted religious people. He said at one point in that book on human nature, the predisposition to religious belief is the most complex and powerful force in the human mind, and in all probability, an ineradicable part of human nature. He also said, God remains a viable hypothesis as the prime mover, however undefinable and untestable that conception may be. I think we may be reading and trying to decipher this man for generations to come.
What he's tried to do is fold religion into the subject areas of sociobiology. Why is this so important to human beings? What does it do for us? How is it part of our ecology, if you will? But of course, he couldn't, without great damage, have rejected his childhood people. And he's really very proud of them now and talks about them in terms of genealogy and so forth. He never felt comfortable at Harvard. I think this is really important. Here was a almost poor boy from Alabama, barefoot boy out in the woods, Huck Finn, who almost couldn't get to college because he didn't have any money, but was able to cobble enough together with family and his own work. Went to the University of Alabama for his BS and his master's degree, and then was kind of plucked by some of the faculty people who recognized his gifts and told, go up to Harvard, talk to those people. You ought to be there, not here. But he went up to Harvard, and Harvard's a pretty snobby place.
Can be, yeah.
It takes a long time to be welcomed into that community, if indeed you ever are at all. He never felt quite at home, and the fact that he is, truth be told, kind of a bomb thrower. He loves to introduce a new idea into the world of biology and see how the ants all scurry around. People really get upset with him because he throws in radical new ideas that they're not ready to absorb yet. That's been the experience he's had with all of these conflicts that occurred across his lifetime. But he's increasingly, in his later years, moved back mentally to Alabama and at least is connected now with the University of Alabama, trying to help that university become a world-class university because, as he points out, that Gulf Coast area in the South has some of the richest freshwater science to be done of any place in the world. And therefore, he's helping them set up the research centers and the labs and the teaching programs that will make that possible. So he's comfortable with his world fame and accepts that as rightly his due, but at the same time has been reconnecting to his roots. He actually wrote a novel a few years ago, didactic novel, to be sure, but it was set in Alabama, and it was about saving a piece of that semi-wilderness that he waded through as a boy. So he's there, but like the rest of us, he's a great jumble of contradictions.
Yeah, and at home even with that.
Well, I mean, it's like the famous remark when some transcendentalist in New England once said ecstatically, I accept the universe. And Ralph Waldo Emerson said, well, she'd better.
On the religious theme, he's also rather humble. He says, we humanists, in so many words, are vastly outnumbered by true believers. So accept that, too. He says men, it appears, would rather believe than know. And that's something important about all of us.
And, of course, he saw that, particularly in the attacks over sociobiology from people who believe deeply in a political system that distorted their science. I think it's fair to say that at this point. That left them prepared to do pretty vicious battle with someone who at that point in his life still didn't have the level of confidence. I mean, he was a pretty shy, awkward, uncertain young man coming from his background. His father committed suicide when he was, I think, in his master's degree year. He had to cope with all of that.
That reminds me of a very provocative, introspective line in your book from Ed Wilson himself saying, in so many words, the scientist is the son of the suicide. And I'm not sure I get it entirely. What did that mean to you?
When I looked at that, I thought this has to be Ed coping with his father. His father was slowly falling apart from advanced alcoholism, drying out and then picking it up again. And Ed looked at him and they talked about it. And his father basically said, I don't want to be one of those Bowery bums, meaning a homeless person who's an organically damaged drunk. His father didn't want to be a burden on everyone. And rather than do that, he took his revolver and walked out one day and sat down by the side of the road and shot himself and left behind a note saying something like, I'm sorry. And it cleared the decks for Ed to leave the South and go north to his future. Because the question had been before that, was Ed going to give up his studies and come back home and take care of his father and his father's wife? And Ed didn't want to do that. And when he told his father that, his father concluded, well, I should get out of the way. And he did get out of the way.
I find it in your book, page 142, the child of a suicide, and who knows better how serious an act of suicide might be, becomes, he said, the biologist. both distancing himself from the subject and preparing to visit his scorn upon philosophers who presume to speak of profound human experience without a matching depth of science. He was trying to put his father's self-destruction in some sociobiological context.
Well, yeah, decorated with sociobiology, but I must tell you, every scientist whose life I have written turned out to have some formative experience, typically before the age of 12, that informs their work and is often the very core of their work for the rest of their lives. For Ed, I think it is the conundrum of meaning versus lack of meaning and optimism versus pessimism. And most of all, how does life work? Why is it so complicated? Why do you take a white handkerchief and you can fold it into multi parts and you just begin to model the complexity of the natural world?
Well said. Last thought, Richard Rhodes. I think somebody should publish the letters that Ed Wilson wrote to his fiancée, Irene Kelly. Reenie, he called her. They met. It was an overwhelming love from the first moment. They danced. They enjoyed each other incredibly. And when he left for the Pacific at the age of 25, not to be back for most of a year, they agreed they would write to each other every single day. And they did.
And they did. There was this extraordinary daily chronicle, like a diary of his remarkable adventures as a young man, fresh out of graduate school, full of enthusiasm, making his way across the South Pacific from island to island at the expense of the Harvard Museum of Natural History, which was paying him to collect ants on these islands, most of which had never been collected before. So he goes looking for the famous bulldog ant, which has giant jaws and will chase you down the road, unlike most ants, which stop when you move away from them. A fierce predator in Australia. He finds those. He met all these interesting people. He met the man who becomes the planter in the musical South Pacific.
Right, he meets Bloody Mary. He's in Bali High, in effect.
They feed him one of the local delicacies, which is fruit bat, which he can't even gag down. It tastes so terrible, although he's just had a bout of tropical fever, so who knows. And he comes home after this 9 months with this giant stack of wonderful letters back and forth, and about 1,000 new specimens of ant that have never before been introduced to science.
I lived in a kind of semi-consciousness of excitement when I started working in New Guinea, for example. This extraordinarily rich island with principally unknown fauna and many kinds of organisms, ants included, was just a hunting ground in which surprises came with each excursion out the door.
Is that the way it works?
That's the way it works.
Now, he's just 26 years old at that point. He's really built his career. And just about the first thing he does after he gets off the plane is pick up Reenie, take her to the nearest cathedral, and they get married. And I think they were married for maybe 70 years, some really long number.
I stumbled on this, which is kind of fascinating. As a young man, and maybe ever after, he puzzled about his own identity. He thought he fit Crane Brinton's definition of the mild anti-intellectual in his 20s and maybe ever after. He said, the anti-intellectual recognizes the tremendous influence of the unconscious mind and conditioned reflex on human thinking and the great inertia of ethical behavior. In other words, he didn't really believe in overthinking things. He was a conservative among intellectuals,
yes,
in some sense.
I mean, Lord knows he's intellectual enough, but he's not an intellectual. I think he sees it as a bit arrogant and rude, really. It's the same thing as his distaste for armchair philosophizing as opposed to drawing your philosophic conclusions from fundamental scientific research. I mean, again, I think it's something of the country boy comes to Harvard.
Yeah.
where people would not treat him very well. And Jim Watson being maybe the prime example, even though nobody particularly liked Jim at Harvard either at that point in his life. To give Watson his due, he and Wilson eventually reconciled and are fast friends now. They understood that they had a big battle going in their respective scientific fields, and as happens with religions when they reach a point of disagreement over basic theology, they just split. The Harvard department split into two. There became one of evolutionary biology and there became one of molecular biology, and that was the way they solved that problem.
Yeah. Richard Rhodes, we're going to be thinking about this man as long as I live and reading him too. I so admire your book, The Scientist, E.O. Wilson, A Life in Nature. Thank you. Thank you for the book, and thank you for all your books, and thank you for this conversation.
Thoroughly enjoyed. Thank you.
And thank you especially to E.O. Wilson himself. Our show this week was produced by Adam Coleman and George Hicks, with engineering help from the WBUR production team. Mary McGrath is the queen in our ant colony. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.